This Week in Virology, the podcast about viruses, the kind that make you sick. This Week in Virology, episode number 119, recorded February 4th, 2011. Hi everyone, I'm Vincent Racaniello, and this is TWIV, the podcast where we talk all about viruses. Today I've given Rich and Alan and Dixon the week off, and I'm bringing you a conversation I had a few weeks ago with David Tuller. David is currently a lecturer in journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. Before that, he was a reporter and editor for 10 years at the San Francisco Chronicle. He's also written about health at Salon.com, and more recently has written health stories for the New York Times. To let you know how I came into touch with David, here's an email he sent me not too long ago. Hi, I'm on the faculty at the Journalism School at Berkeley, and I'm also coordinator of a newly created joint master's program in public health and journalism. I'm also a frequent contributor to the New York Times, particularly the Tuesday Health Science section. Over the summer, I wrote the most recent in the paper about chronic fatigue syndrome and XMRV/MLV-related viruses last summer. I'm writing another piece about what's happened with the science since then, obviously including this week's retrovirology papers. I read your posts and would be interested in talking with you either this week or next. My response to the papers was more along the lines of your reconsidered view. Given the noise around the papers, I kind of expected a knockout blow of XMRV/MLV-related viruses or some way they were going to connect their own finding of contamination directly to the Lombardi and Alter Low studies, but they didn't. They definitely showed that contamination could be an issue, and yet they seemed to frame it as if the fact that they identified contamination means no one else can be uncontaminated. I don't see the logic. Thanks, hope to talk with you. So after I received that email, I did speak with David, and he wrote an article in the Times about this, which I will link to in the show notes. Shortly afterwards, he told me he'd be in New York for a week, so I asked him to come by to the TWIV studio and talk with me about science and journalism. So what follows is our conversation on that day, which was January 13th, 2011. I'll be back on the other side of my talk with David with some closing comments. I'm speaking with Dave Tuller today. He's originally from New York, currently living in San Francisco, and you're a professor of journalism at Berkeley.
I'm a lecturer in journalism at Berkeley. We have to keep our titles straight.
And does that pay the bills?
I'm full-time. Yeah, so it's actually more than I was making when I was working at the San Francisco Chronicle.
So before you went to Berkeley, you were at the San Francisco Chronicle.
Well, a long, 12 years ago. I quit the Chronicle in 98. I was there for 10 years. I moved there to take that job from New York. And I had covered health a lot. In 2005, I guess, or 2004, I went to Berkeley and got a master's in public health. Not knowing exactly what I would do afterwards, but figuring I'd somehow figure something out.
And that was because you had been writing about health-related
issues? Yeah, because I've been writing about health-related issues for about 15 years. And as happens at newspapers, when you start writing about health, they say, oh, cover health. That's all they tell you. They don't say, this is what the health beat is, this is what you should do, this is how you understand health. They just say, cover health. And then you sort of figure it out on your own.
Is there any reason why they asked you to cover health? Had you had training in that area?
Well, I hadn't had really training, but I covered health. I started covering health because I started doing a lot of work on HIV and AIDS. I'm gay, so in San Francisco, and I was one of the few gay reporters at the paper. And so I started covering gay issues and then gay health issues, and then that sort of morphed into covering health issues in general. And then for a while, I was the editor of the health and science, or the health, the sort of science and environmental and health reporters at the paper. And then I quit. And then anyway, later on, I thought, okay, I was approaching my late 40s, and I thought, okay, what am I going to do for my next, thing? So I got a master's in public health. I subsequently also was writing for the Times for the health section. Mm-hmm. So I was still sort of keeping my hand in reporting. And then when I finished my master's, I had already been teaching in the journalism school how to report about public health, and the idea came up or I proposed, and it was in line with what Berkeley wanted, which was to create this combined double master's program in public health and journalism. One, because nobody had one. Two, because every year there's some students in journalism who really want to study public health, and there's some students in public health who really want to study journalism. And they could do it, but they have to jump through a lot of bureaucratic hoops to actually make it work. So each school has had dual degree programs with other schools at Berkeley, but they've had very little traditionally to do with each other. And, you know, when we started talking about this idea, everybody said, oh, no brainer. Sounds like a great idea. So we've spent the last couple of years, you know, working the proposal, shepherding it through the Berkeley bureaucracy, which is no easy task. We finally got approval last summer, this past summer. And so we actually have some applicants for the fall. So people ask me, oh, what are the graduates doing? I'm like, we don't have any graduates. We don't even have any students yet. We're just starting. We're going to have a small program. We'll probably have, you know, 2 to 6 students a year, maximum 6, is what we're sort of allotted to be able to have. So, you know, I don't know exactly who the students will be, if they'll be primarily journalism who really want to study public health, or primarily public health people who want to be out there also reporting and doing media and communicating. But hopefully a mix of those two, because I like the synergy of bringing students from each one together.
So clearly there are a lot of health related issues to write about.
Right.
So in general, journalists aren't trained to do that, right?
Yeah, not at all.
Did you have any science training at all?
No. And I was a real kind of humanities, social science-y, kind of squishy, you know, touchy-feely kind of more person. So I, my father was a doctor, and we had a problematic relationship, and that probably, I think, turned me off to the idea of being a doctor and medicine and science and all that kind of stuff. I at one point wanted to be a tennis pro, and my dad was like, he wasn't happy with, my mom didn't care, but he wasn't happy with that idea. And in fact, it wasn't until after he passed away that I'd been covering health, but I didn't really make any effort to go to public health school or anything study until after he was already gone. But once I went back to school, immediately my reporting improved, you know, because, you know, when you start reporting about health, I mean, you don't understand the difference between an observational study and an experimental study, or, you know, how much can you tell from a case control study, or, you know, it's very difficult because it's just a completely other, sure, you know, language. Sure. And, you know, I can't remember, you know, whether I mixed up virus and bacteria, but I'm sure I did at some point that nobody noticed, or, you know, something like that. I'm sure I made those, you know, and I tell my students, you know, you can do that once. You can make that mistake once, but if you make it twice, forget it.
I just saw last week there was a press release from an Australian newspaper. They've released modified mosquitoes in Australia to try and control dengue.
Oh, okay. Are they having a dengue resurgence?
In the one city, Cairns, they had 1,000 cases last year. So it's not huge, but
I would think after the flooding, they're going to have a lot
more. They might have more. They've actually modified the mosquitoes to contain a bacterium called Wolbachia, which is a symbiont. It's good for the mosquito. Mm-hmm. So it might remain in the mosquito population. So one press release I had seen called Wolbachia, first a virus and then a bacterium.
Whoops.
Right now, there are many journalists writing about science.
Right.
And few of them have science training.
Right.
So your idea of having a dual master's program in journalism and public health is to try and make journalists who can understand the science better.
Well, that's half of it. The other half, and that's what the public health school was excited about initially, was like, oh, we're going to have journalists who understand our issues. And it's taken me the last 2 or 3 years for them to really get to the point where they realize, oh, we actually need to be communicating better as public health people as well. We need to understand the media. We need to know how it works. We need to be, you know, we want to be doing our own blogging or our own writing or, you know, our own kind of communicating. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, practitioner communicators now, you know, some high profile ones, as you know, and then others, you know, just more, you know, the Jerome Groupmans and Atul Gawande's,
right,
and so on. But then there's a lot of other people who are just, you know, like you, blogging or, you know,
right,
doing other kinds of ways in which they're trying to communicate, not just with their colleagues, with a larger audience. And so I think it's taken a couple of years for the School of Public Health to realize that they haven't been traditionally really good on communication strategies as part of the public health education. Mm. And so I think now they've come to see that, yeah, it is a dual degree program. It's not just like the programs that other journalism schools have, where they are teaching some health reporting or science reporting, but the students aren't really getting the full immersion in the discipline. And so I want students to be able to come out, and if they want to go on and do public health research, or, you know, as master's student, you know, people with master's degrees in public health, or they want to be getting involved in some other, you know, great.
Sure.
Use that expertise and also write about it.
Yeah, because it's a common saying that most scientists can't communicate. Mm-hmm. So if they come out of that program, at least at the master's level, they might have some better communication.
Right, and
skills.
Hopefully they won't do some of the what I was starting to do when I was trying to write. You know, so in one sense, after I got as I was getting my master's, the questions I asked as a reporter were, you know, got more sophisticated, I guess, and I think my understanding of things, improved. However, occasionally I wrote mainstream pieces that were really way too wonky and way too kind of boring for a non-public health audience. And so I also have to watch myself on that side the audience I'm writing for is, and be aware of that. But yeah, my hope is that, you know, I mean, I'm probably in a way think of myself more as a journalist at this point, since that's what I was doing, you know, much more of my life. And since I've had my public health master's, but so I, you know, really hope that we do get some great students and that they really go out there and do some really terrific reporting.
One of the things I wonder, so you want to make journalists better at understanding science and communicating it, but is a master's in public health enough to do that?
Well, probably not, but let's just say it's better than no master's in public health. you know, I'm not going to think, oh, people have to have a doctorate, you know, because...
Although that would be great, wouldn't it?
That would be great. And obviously, if I had a doctorate in virology, you know, I wouldn't have had to necessarily call you to, you know, to vet my, you know, or to double check all my sort of understandings of the papers. So, yeah, having a master's gets you, you know, part way. It doesn't get you all the way, but the truth is, you know, nothing's going to get you all the way, except if you're totally immersed in that world. And if you're immersed in that world, then you're not going to be a journalist.
Well, even if you had a PhD in virology, when a story on a bacterium or a parasite came along, or some other medical story, you wouldn't necessarily be an expert.
Or something completely out of infectious diseases.
So you can't possibly be an expert in everything.
Right.
But you can understand the basic underpinnings, as you said before. The difference between association and causation.
Even basically the difference between prevalence and incidence, the difference between efficacy and effectiveness in studies, the difference between, and I should just explain maybe efficacy is how things perform in a study, and effectiveness is how they perform in the real world. And effectiveness is always, almost always lower than the efficacy. Right. Not a completely easy concept. I mean, it's not intuitive to people. And so it's intuitive if you're immersed in that, but it's not intuitive if you're not.
Sure.
The students come in, they don't really know the difference between a virus and a bacteria. And they certainly don't know what a parasite is as opposed to, a helminth or a protozoa, whatever.
Sure. No,
they don't know any of that stuff.
Right. I know from trying to teach people, it's not easy. Many people understand, but many still don't. And it's very difficult.
But another thing I'll say, so for example, reading studies, I can't fully understand them because I'm not a statistician. So I have no idea if this statistical test, I don't know if this is the right statistical test for that particular thing they're looking for. I could have a doctorate in virology, but I still wouldn't know that.
So you would have to find someone who could tell you.
Yeah.
That's the key in journalism, is to find an expert. But I'm told that there's no time these days to do that.
That's a real problem. There's several things happening. In the media, obviously newspapers have shrunk, and they've lost a lot of experienced reporters, and a lot of science, and health, science is often, it's not as important as politics in the eyes of, newspaper editors, necessarily.
Right. Or entertainment, even.
Or entertainment, or, Sarah Palin's, video yesterday or whatever, or who's winning the Oscars. So, so I think papers have cut back on what they see as sort of somewhat expendable areas, which is often, and not health so much, because, everybody's interested in health.
Sure.
Everybody's incredibly interested in health. However, you know, most health journalism uses the word breakthrough. You know, they use these classic breakthrough, mm-hmm. miracle drug. You know, there's a lot of, especially, you know, I think TV and broadcast reporting, which is very credulous. And any new study is, you know, the latest cure for the cold or that kind of thing. And there's kind of a lot of emphasis on miracle cures and mm-hmm. breakthroughs, scientific breakthroughs. And most things aren't breakthroughs. And again, you know, reporters get press releases. And as we have seen with this XMRV situation, the press releases aren't always accurately reflecting the state of the science, but the reporters don't necessarily either have the time or, you know, inclination, really the time often, or the knowledge to really understand the study and sort of spend the time to sort of try to figure it out. So I think there's a structural problem in media, and especially in the domain I'm most familiar with, which is newspaper reporting. On the other hand, though, there's a lot of really incredible reporting going on online. And one of the things about reporting now is that so much more information is immediately accessible to you. So everybody complains about the shrinking of the newspapers. But the truth is, any normal person can go on now and find so much information that they used to rely on the newspaper for. Or they find your blog, and then they get a better understanding than they probably would if they read their local paper anyway, because you write in a way that's sort of accessible to people. So even though the kind of legacy media, as we like to call them, often are cutting back and have less room for this stuff, there's so much more available online, and people themselves are writing their own blogs and doing their own kind of reporting and setting up their own, you know, mm-hmm. websites. So there's a lot of great reporting. It's just not necessarily something you're going to find in the Chicago Tribune. You might still find it in the New York Times, you know, Washington Post, but those are rarities.
So if someone went to an online version of a well-known newspaper like the Times or the Chicago Tribune or your former paper, Chronicle, right?
We won't talk about that one.
They can have some faith that it's a reasonable representation of truth, if you will. But if any blog that they find online, they just don't know.
No, but then they need to, right. I mean, and one of the things hopefully is that I think, it's true, you just don't know. But it's sort of like going to the dentist. If the dentist says you need 6 root canals, you also don't know. You know, at some point, you just have to rely on their credentials as someone who knows their field or someone who, you know, is, you know, experienced in a domain and have some faith that and use your judgment.
So when you look at blogs, how do you determine if they're credible or not? Do you have series of steps that you go through?
You know, I look at the tone. First, I look if it's well-written, okay? So if it's not well-written, then I already have a problem kind of slogging through it because, you know, to me, if they can't think through their thoughts clearly, then I'm not sure, you know, the rest of it. But again, I look at your blog. Okay, so you're a professor of microbiology at Columbia. Okay, well, that could be a fluke. You could be a bird brain, you know, and somehow. but, you know, I put some credit in Columbia's ability to pick intelligent people, and you know, what I read on your blog around XMRV, seemed to conform to my impression of the papers. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm just confirming my own, you know, biases in a way, or I was confirming my own good instincts by talking to you or calling you. And, you know, I think on your blog in this incident where you sort of apologized, which, you know, did have a big, I think, impact. If you look at the blogosphere of, you know, chronic fatigue syndrome blogs, people were commenting on that. And so, that seemed like an interesting thing to do. And so it seemed like an interesting thing to report about and an interesting demonstration of what was going on in this debate and the confusion around these studies and why it's so hard for people to understand them.
Well, I just think it's important for people to know, at least in science, which is what I do, that there are ways to figure out which blogs are straightforward or reasonable or true or whatever. I try not to opinionate. I try to explain the science. Mm-hmm. There are many, many science blogs where the writers opinionate. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that's what I want to do. I want to teach people the fundamentals so that they can go and eventually understand it mm-hmm. on their own.
Well, what do you look for in a blog?
I like to know who's writing it, if they have some credentials in the area that they're writing. And I'm just talking about science. I mean, I don't read many non-science blogs.
Right.
'Cause that's a whole different ball of wax right there. If I know who they are, that's great, or if they're from a credible place. If they have a research background, that's really good as well. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. If it's written well, that really helps because it means that they've taken time to craft each piece, mm-hmm. and that's important.
You know, and
if they teach me something.
With the XMRV piece that I wrote last week, you know, that's something where it's like, just in terms of looking over how people write, it's like, I really had to, with this topic, you know what it's like, sure. and you touch this topic, it's like a red poker. I mean, it's like, you know, one word that seems astray or seems to implicate something or seems to suggest something, and the entire chronic fatigue syndrome community, it gets concerned and expresses mm-hmm. itself. So I really, you know, with that kind of thing, I really try to be very, very, you know, completely careful. And that's one good thing about being a freelancer also, is I have a little more time than when I was working at a daily newspaper where you have right. to write everything in 10 minutes. You know, so this, I mean, I really tried to make sure that there was really right down the middle, and that there wasn't anything that was kind of a trigger for unwarranted, you know, anxiety or unwarranted, you know,
sure.
Response.
So we're talking about your latest piece
one,
in
yeah,
the New York Times
week, yeah.
on XMR, on basically talking about these four papers in retrovirology.
And
chronic fatigue
what they
syndrome.
Mean or what they don't mean.
Well, that was well received, as you know, as I pointed out to you.
Yes, yeah, so that was the hero for the day in the chronic fatigue syndrome community. But next week I could write something and they could hate me.
So do you think this is, I'm not sure, maybe since you've covered AIDS and HIV before, mm-hmm. You could answer this. Is it common when there is a disease that affects many people for which there isn't a known etiology or cure that the community gets very much involved? Was that the case with AIDS?
Yeah, okay, so that's interesting. I hadn't really thought of it that way. But yes, as a gay man who, you know, from New York, who moved to San Francisco mm-hmm. in the middle of the whole thing, and, you know, was very aware in the 80s and less from the 90s, but in the 80s of sort of the way in which the disease was not taken seriously, and way in which was just dismissed as mm-hmm. you know, gays and drug addicts, and or even if it was gays and drug addicts, that by itself meant it could be dismissed. I was early on, before I moved to San Francisco, I was involved with ACT UP in New York when they first started. So I'm very sensitive to how patient communities respond mm-hmm. to news about them. And I do think that in the area of chronic fatigue syndrome, the community has a lot of reasons to be upset, and a lot of reasons, whatever the etiology turns out to be, whether it turns out to be viral or not. I think looking back over the history of how people with chronic fatigue syndrome have been treated by the medical establishment, the medical profession, has been kind of shameful. And overall, I would say, and I really understand a patient community becoming activist and getting upset, and as they should. I mean, that's their function to some yeah. degree. Not to disrupt science,
sure.
But they have an interest in it.
I think the echoing is much greater now, because when AIDS first came on, we didn't have blogging
Absolutely.
And internet to the extent that we have it today.
Right. And I think what would have happened is that had there been blogs, ACTIV would have been started in 1984 mm-hmm. instead of 1987 or 88 and 87. I think that mobilizing would have happened much quicker. And what happened with HIV, and what also I think has happened a little bit with chronic fatigue syndrome, is that you have lay people who become experts in the science and challenge the scientists at their own game, and challenge the regulatory authorities as to their approach to, mm-hmm. say, fast-lining drugs and so on. And now there's this debate, as you know, about the use of ARVs among people with chronic fatigue syndrome, and do they, you know, should they be able to do, you know, should doctors prescribe them, and should they be able to take them, and do they have the right to decide they want yeah. to take them, even though, you know, there's no evidence that they would work. You know, the medical establishment often tries to, I think, assert its authority to sort of make definitive and final statements, and don't want to be challenged by anybody.
Yeah, sure.
And don't like it when people challenge not just their approach, but their kind of preconceptions about how they should be approaching what they're doing. And anytime you have an activist patient community in whatever disease it is, and they all take their, you know, their lessons from the AIDS activists, in a way. And so, you know, nobody likes that. Why should they? Why should they like being criticized by you know, patients. They're patients. We're supposed to tell them what to do.
So you think the public commenting has an effect on public health policy and research?
I think the pressure has an effect on public health policy. You know, probably not always for the best. I mean, I think the problem is, you know, human beings, I think, don't like ambiguity. And the problem is with most of this stuff is there's a lot of ambiguity.
Sure.
And there's no definitive answers. And so.
Well, I got it wrong initially, too.
Well, you did, too, but partly, okay. But
I think paper is very, you have to read it very carefully. And I think a lot of scientists did not.
Mm-hmm.
And
but the commentary put them more in perspective. The commentary was measured by, I forget what his name was.
And the retrovirology journal, you mean the commentary that was published?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was measured for sure.
Yeah.
It was much more so than the original article.
Yeah. Right.
But I think it's a difficult article to read. My feeling is that if you came into that with a feeling one way or the other, you basically stuck to it. Because I think most people didn't read it. And those who did, well, there are some smart people. When I first read it, I read it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very subtle paper, and I had to take input from other virologists before mm-hmm. I was able to realize it's not as straightforward.
Right,
as
so having a doctorine in virology, I guess, is not complete.
Not always.
It's not immunity
not
against
being completely but it gives you the ability to change your mind.
Uh-huh.
So on face value, the issue in that paper is the variability in the virus from this cell line versus people. And if you take that as a given, that's pretty compelling
mm-hmm.
that there's much less variation in people. That doesn't make any sense. But in fact, that may not be the case.
Mm-hmm.
Experimentally, it may not be correct that there's less variation.
Right.
So that's not an easy thing to tease out of it.
And they also demonstrate the idea that they didn't address at least the emerging signs of some evidence that were not related to PCR. They didn't address those at all. Which they didn't set out to do. That's fine.
Sure.
It's not a criticism of the papers that they didn't address that.
Right.
But the statements afterwards did not address that they didn't address that.
Well, this is one of the issues with science. Scientists work pretty much independently.
Mm-hmm.
And here, maybe not everyone knows this, but science goes forward because it's initiated pretty much by initial independent investigators.
Mm-hmm.
I have an idea. I write a grant. I get support for it, and I do it. No one tells you should work on this. Well, there are some cases where the NIH, for example, has some money to work on certain things, and they could certainly do that with XMRV. But for the most part, it's driven by scientists. So, and then you have a result, and you make your conclusions, and that's what Greg Towers did. He felt he was right. But none of us are always right.
Mm-hmm.
And so he probably should have been a little more circumspect. One of the most calming influences, I think, in this whole area is John Coffin.
Mm-hmm.
He said he published two of those papers, but
right.
he said this doesn't mean that anything that we've done before or anyone else has done before is wrong.
Right,
this just says be careful. But this is all an interesting question. This whole problem, which came up in one of the comments on my blog, you have a press release, in this case by the Wellcome Trust, which is then picked up by
everybody.
Organization. They just repeat it. And then everyone thinks, this is the end. So, and that press release basically reflected Greg Towers' opinion of his works.
Right? And one of the, I'm sorry.
And so what do we do about that?
Well, I mean, I think you write articles and saying, no, this is wrong. He's wrong. When you start talking to people with chronic fatigue syndrome and you find out that they're college professors, you know, Laura Hillenbrand, who wrote two best-selling books, The Seabiscuit, and what's the most recent one, about someone in World War II. And, you know, I mean, these are not malingerers. These are not people who want to get out of work, you know,
right.
straight-A students. I mean, they're not, when you talk to people and you talk to them about their experiences
mm-hmm.
and how they've been, how doctors have talked to them.
Right.
You gain a lot of empathy. I mean, one of the jobs of reporting is to try to is an empathy job. You talk to people and you try to understand their experience from their perspective. And when you see, and when you know the history that for 25 years now, there's been suspicions of there being a viral etiology and these people really do have elevated antibody titers to Epstein-Barr. I don't know what all that exactly means. There clearly seems to be some immune dysfunction problem going on in people's bodies. Now, what's causing it? It seems to me hard to believe that that's all psychogenic. Why are they spending so little on a disease that they themselves claim affects 2.5% of the population? It makes no sense.
Well, it should go up at least for XMRV.
Hopefully. Right?
Because this is a relatively, well, it's actually a virus that's been around for a while, but now awareness of virologists is raised. Mm-hmm. And my colleague here, Steve Goff, for example, is working on it. And when...
What's he working on?
So originally he collaborated with Ela Singh, who used to be here.
Right, and she's at Utah.
She's now at Utah. And they initially made antibodies against the virus, which she is now using to screen her patient samples. Steve Goff is interested in how this virus replicates in cultured cells. It happens to be one of the few marine viruses that grows really well. Mm-hmm. And it grows particularly well in human cells of prostate origin, which begs the question of whether that's relevant to prostate cancer.
But could that possibly, could it be contamination? I mean, if it actually grows in human cells, mm-hmm. there's obviously human transmission, I mean, transmission between those cells going on, or is it?
It could be, but it's clearly a murine virus. Right. It looks very much like viruses that infect mice.
So the question is it really an endogenous murine leukemia virus that sort of somehow gotten into these cell lines and manages to replicate in these cell lines, but mm-hmm. isn't actually causing disease in humans?
That's the question. It can certainly infect human cells. So the origin of the virus in human cells is probably when human tumors were implanted into mice mm-hmm. years ago in order to propagate them. The tumors became infected with the XMRV, right. which is in mice, and then the tumors are removed from mice, cell cultures are made, and now you have XMRV-infected cell cultures. So this 22RV1 cell line, which Greg Towers right. used, that's the origin of it, came from a tumor that went through a mouse, and
right.
that's probably where it got XMRV. How it got into people is the question. And there's a very nice review article out now which suggests that...
Or if it got into people is the question, because Greg Towers, I understand, it doesn't think it's in people. He only thinks it's in the cell lines.
Greg Towers just thinks it's in the cell lines, exactly. But there is evidence that it's in people that has to be dealt with. There's
right.
the original Lombardi et al. Study, which found not only PCR evidence, but also antibodies in people.
Right.
And it needs to be expanded by others.
Right.
And as you know, we have about 75 papers now with mixed results. So what has to happen and what will happen is that we will reach a consensus.
Mm-hmm. And what's the time frame you think for that kind of work?
I mean, I thought it would be sorted out last year.
Uh-huh.
So I'm
I mean,
a little
I saw Lipkin
cautious.
Was saying at least a year till his.
Yeah, his study, which is to see. They're blinding samples which are known to have virus or not, and they're sending them to different laboratories on a large scale to see if it can be replicated and what kind of assay you need to use to do this. I mean, these are fundamental things
right.
that have to be developed first, right?
I'm actually supposed to go here. Judy Mikovits is giving a talk next Monday in Santa Rosa.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to go. I've never met her. I've talked to her on the phone, but I was going to go, and I don't know if she's going to be presenting any new findings or anything, or if it's, I think it's partly informational for the chronic fatigue syndrome patient community,
right.
and partly I think there's sort of doctors and,
yeah.
some other scientists or, whatever.
Yeah, I've got a lot of requests from listeners of my podcast to have her on as a guest, which I think is appropriate,
because
she, after all, did the original study,
right.
and we've been talking to everyone except that group, so we will do that. One of the problems is that she does talk to groups, as you will see, and presents data, and then the patients come around and they post it, and they say, what about this and what about that? And it's very difficult to evaluate because it's not peer-reviewed.
Right.
Now, peer review isn't the best. It's sort of like democracy.
Right.
But it's not great, but it's the best thing we have. And if you don't have peer review, you don't know about controls, you don't know how experiments were done. When someone just gets up in front of an audience, they can do anything. And I'm not saying that she is, but it's hard to evaluate. They should publish it. I've also heard say that the Institute doesn't have enough money to finish all this up. In the end, you have to get the data to make a convincing paper.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, nothing will go forward. That's just the way science works.
Right.
Right. So that has to be done. I would love to see that. Now, one thing that I'm interested in, I'm on the study section of NIH, and we review virology grants. So we're meeting next month. It'd be interesting to see if there are any XMRV grants in
mm-hmm.
there, because that's part of how the science goes forward.
Now, would
people get interested.
Any grants related to XMRV go through your panel? I mean, are there other, like, when they, do they divide it up? I mean, is there one virology panel, or are there multiple ones dealing with, is there a chronic fatigue syndrome panel, or this panel, or there is...
There is... There are two virology panels and seven for HIV.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I don't know that there's an XMRV panel, but it could be that at some point there would be. So right now these grants would come through one of the two virology studies.
Just as an addendum, one of the reasons why the name is such a bad name is that it leads people to say chronic fatigue instead of chronic fatigue syndrome.
Sure.
And it's not chronic fatigue. And that's part of what allows the entire population to make jokes about, oh, yeah, I have that too. You know, I had to make all breakfast for my five kids. Like, you know, like someone said.
So what
to
do
me.
You think would be an appropriate name?
You know, I mean, diseases have all kinds of names. And, you know, nobody's really complains. I mean, I guess people complain about, you know, other diseases. I think it's a problem when you take a term that has a... It's kind of a false cognate when that's that means something to normal people, fatigue, and you use it to apply to the kind of you use it as if it's parallel to the kind of symptom that these people have, which is not the fatigue that someone gets after a long ski weekend. It's a profound exhaustion that, and the only thing I can think of comparable when I've heard the description is when I was dehydrated and I felt like I couldn't lift one leg above, you know, to move. Because I was so weighted down. I mean, that was like absolute exhaustion. And it's hard for me to imagine what it would be like to have that feeling constantly. You know, mainly now it's called ME/CFS.
Right.
You know, I don't know what a good name would be. I mean, I'm not a branding, you know, person, but I just know intuitively that chronic fatigue syndrome is not the right name.
So let's go back to AIDS. What was it first called?
GRID.
GRID.
Gay-related immune disorder.
So probably... People were not happy about that, right?
Well, people were not happy about that, but I think the one thing was that at least it brought it... I mean, you know, gay people are so used to being ignored, so at least that made gay people pay attention, and at least that was somewhat descriptive because it was first identified in gay men. So there was some descriptive rationale for that.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember, you know, it's 30 years ago, almost 30 years. I can't quite remember my own reaction at the time as a 23-year-old or whatever it was when it first... to the name. I know the name AIDS did not do really a good, was not a good name for that, those, that AIDS diet reduction thing. Do you remember those?
Yes.
AYDS. It disappeared pretty quickly.
Right.
Take one of these and you lose 100 pounds. I don't think people would.
So it remained GRID until virus was identified?
I can't remember. I think it remained GRID only, it was only probably GRID for about a year or two. And then because there were, maybe because, I don't remember what, by 83 it had morphed into AIDS because when they sort of announced that they'd found the virus, I think they already were calling it that. You know, but then we had a whole other series of, because also, I mean, it was identified in the gay men in the first, you know, the MMWR paper originally, but, you know, then there were the Haitians and then there were the hemophiliacs and the drug users.
Sure.
And so it quickly became clear that it was at least four cohorts.
Are you planning any future articles on XMRV, chronic fatigue syndrome?
You know, I think I'll probably follow the, you know, I mean, I'll keep following the news. I have, you know, I'm sort of trying to get I'm trying to get a doctorate in public health finished because I did a first year of it. It's not a PhD. It's what's called a DRPH, Doctor of Public Health. So it's actually shorter. We have to do everybody thinks of a mega dissertation, but my prospectus is supposed to be three related papers.
Right.
You know, three papers on a thing. So I've got to write my prospectus this spring and, you know, spend the next, probably I'll hopefully be done by the end of the next year. So I don't have a huge amount. I mean, I keep my hand in reporting, but I don't have a huge amount of, you know, plus I'm teaching, plus we have our new program starting. So I don't have a lot of discretionary time.
So when you write, is it mainly for the New York Times?
Yeah, mainly these days it is. I mean, I do some work, you know, some magazine work, you know, but mostly just because it's easy, it's high, you know, it's the time, you know, it's my hometown newspaper actually. So that's part of it too.
Sure. Of course.
I wrote a book a number of years ago. I'd like to do another book, but I just haven't gotten it together.
So your program is going to train, you know, six people a year once it gets going, but that's not enough to serve all the organizations in the world that need people who understand science. So
What else do I do? You know, I'm one person. I can do my little bit in the world, and other people have to figure out the other things. I think there's a basic disconnect, which is that science is complicated, and people's attention spans are short. And, you know, I think one of the tricks in doing science or health reporting is trying to figure out how much of the detail is necessary to understand the essence of the story, mm-hmm. and how much is just excess. And, you know, I'm hoping that other schools, I mean, I'm hoping that, you know, Columbia, you know, I'm hoping that we have a good program and that other schools kind of replicate it.
You know, when you told me that, I started to look at our program here at Columbia, our journalism program, mm-hmm. and I didn't see anything. And I thought of contacting someone and volunteering my help to start such a program.
Oh, that would be great. I mean, I just went yesterday to the journalism school just to tell, you know, they have a, in addition to the 1 year Masters of Science in Journalism, mm-hmm. they have a Masters of Arts program, which is for experienced journalists or as a second year.
Right.
You know, Berkeley is a 2 year journalism program. Columbia is 1 year. So they have this Masters of Arts now, and you can specialize in science and health reporting, you know, science, I guess science, environment. A lot of them link, you know, science, environmental, and health are all sort of in the mishmash together. So you can go to Columbia if you're a journalist or an experienced journalist, or if you've just finished your basic journalism master's and get a, you know, health reporting track. Mm-hmm. And that's really good. I mean, NYU has one as well. I think BU has one. I mean, a number of schools, journalism schools, have a health track, which I think is great. I mean, I think that's an important step. But I'm also in the business. I'm also in public health. I'd like public health people to learn how to communicate better and to be more people blogging like you and more people, so more people can have direct access to the voice of the scientists. Mm-hmm. I think that's also important. So I think any ways that people in the sciences can figure out how to work with journalists and make their work more understandable, you know, would be great. So if that's more joint programs, I think that would be, I mean, that's part of the reason I'm sort of trying to meet people and just say, hey, this is what we're doing. You know, I don't feel like, oh, there's only room for one such program.
Yeah, I think that we have a good School of Public Health here. It would be a perfect melding. But I think also you might include some other courses. So I teach a virology course down at Morningside, and this would be good for journalists to take. Mm-hmm. You could have them, in addition to learning public health, take a few focused courses that would teach them principles of infection.
Right.
Virology is a good one because all the principles are there, and they really apply to bacteria and parasites as well.
Well, in public health schools mostly, I think all of them probably, people actually apply for a particular division. So like in journalism, you just apply to the journalism school.
Right.
In public health, you apply to epidemiology, infectious diseases, you know, environmental health sciences. So like at Berkeley, we have 8 or 9 departments. And so 4 of them are participating, in this introductory phase of our program. So, infectious disease, epidemiology, health and social behavior, which is like community health education, mm-hmm. and environmental health sciences. So the students who come to our program, like if they're in infectious diseases, you know, they'll be taking infectious diseases, they'll be taking infectious disease lab, and they'll be taking their journalism, as well as their basic core public health requirements. So
I think that's great. I think the more programs that do that, the better off we'll be in the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, there is a problem in science reporting. You would agree,
yeah,
right?
I would agree.
I mean, the echoing of a press release that is overstating is an example.
Well, you know, and it's one of the cardinal lessons. You know, we had a big blow up in San Francisco a couple of years ago with those, MRSA. So it's bacterial. It was, high, you know, where they had found high rates of MRSA in, among gay men, you know, in the gay, in the, you know, the gay zip code or the gay, you know, the Castro zip code. And there were sort of various ways in which they were sort of positioning MRSA as something that was in the community was popping up more reliably among the gay male population than in the general population. And so there was another situation where all around the world, it was reported as new gay plague, you know, gay, and there was, and the tone of it was, gay men are poised to infect the general population with this, you know, this is going to spread from gay men to the general population. And there was a real problem with the phrasing of that understanding in the press release. And so UCSF, you know, there was a big outcry in the gay community. UCSF had to kind of not retract the study. They didn't retract their statements. Mm-hmm. Again, right. It was talking about the study that was the problem. It wasn't the study itself. And, you know, it's partly a problem. I mean, it's partly a problem because human beings miscommunicate. It's not like people are being venal or evil. It's just partly they're miscommunicating. They don't really understand the implications of their words. And, you know, I think it's always going to happen.
Well, but, I did.
What was it like for you to have to apologize?
Well, I read the papers.
Did you feel bad? Like, or did you feel like, oh no, or did you feel like, well, I'll just correct it?
Yeah, I felt badly, sure, because I know a lot of people listen to what I write.
Mm-hmm.
And because I communicate with the public about viruses, that's what I want to do. And it was wrong. So I felt bad. It's like in my class, if I tell them something wrong and I've done it, the next lecture I fix it.
Mm-hmm.
I have all my lectures online, and you can see several examples where I'll start off a lecture. Before we go on, I want to correct an error I made last time.
Mm. Well, you know, my story before this one that ran in the summer was when the Alter Lowe study was published.
Yes.
And so, you know, we went all, you know, we everybody, I read this, you know, anyway, the first sentence, I wrote MRV-related viruses. You know, I wrote XMRV and MRV-related viruses. Mm-hmm. And, you know, immediately, well, it's not MLV-related viruses. It's not MRV-related viruses. It's MLV-related viruses. But I mentioned MRV-related viruses. You know, it's like five or six times in the piece, and I didn't see it. I mean, I knew it was MLV-related. Mm-hmm. So, of course, we have to run a correction.
Yeah.
And it's not a substantive correction. It's obviously anybody could make that transposition of letters, but it's still mortifying,
sure,
you know, as a... Someone putting information out there.
You can see that some people would question your credibility.
Right. And not unreasonably.
And this actually relates back to something you said. You said people are in a hurry and they don't have a lot of time. I'm actually amazed at how many people read my blog and listen to my podcast. We have about 2,000 to 3,000 people a day reading the blog and 10,000 to 20,000 listeners. So I think there are a lot of people out there who want to learn science, who want to learn virology. So that's good. Not everyone needs to be entertained all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Some science, which is what this is, and it's not easy, is actually appealing to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. And when did you start doing the
podcast?
Yeah.
September 2008. It's just over 2 years. And the blog, I think I started in 2004.
And so the podcast, you just do these and then you post them whenever?
I have a schedule. We do one every week.
Uh-huh. And do you edit them down to a certain length?
I don't, no. But we get excited about the subject material, and we talk.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the public's interest in science is much greater than we think.
Mm-hmm.
But my view is that I know all scientists can't teach or communicate, but those who can should, because there you have the best feeling for the subject matter. You have someone who's done it all their life.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to teach it in a very different way from... a writer.
Right, totally.
You probably know that the CDC did publish one small study last year on chronic fatigue syndrome and XMRV, and it was negative.
Right.
But it was very dismissive, and it was a very small study.
And there was also, there was that whole kind of dueling studies sort of trope between NIH and, you know, NIH FDA study and the retrovirology study. The CDC published, and you know, it's interesting that that retrovirology also published the subsequent negative studies. You know, it sort of certainly would support their decision to publish the CDC study.
Yeah.
If you look just at where the studies were published, and you want to stack science and proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences against retrovirology, I would pick science and proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences just based on high profile you know, whatever.
Well, journals make mistakes too.
Well, that's true too. So all I'm saying is that the effort, and if there's an effort to portray this as a fringe findings or sort of somehow, I mean, I think there was an effort with the there was a tenor of the subsequent, after the science paper, after the subsequent findings, you know, were all sort of negative. And then there was a lot of talk like this was just an outlier or, you know, the Science paper, the Mikovits Lombardi paper was just an outlier and freakish or something, and really off the wall. And, you know, that's hard to do anymore, given that there's other high-profile people, I think, involved.
Well, eventually it'll sort out. Science does. Mm-hmm. It finds the correct level, and it doesn't, the journal is not so important. It's the collective literature on a topic. In this case, does XMRV cause prostate cancer or chronic fatigue syndrome? Eventually we'll get an answer. Mm-hmm. We're not there yet either way. But I'm confident that the science will work.
I hope so.
I've seen it. I've seen it for 30 years, and questions get resolved eventually because it's more than any one investigator, science. Science is science itself.
Right. Right?
So I'm confident. I don't know how long it will take. It may take more than just a year.
Well, the initial reports were like they would sort of work this out within a few months, but it doesn't sound like that's necessarily
going to happen. I think they need to work out the assays in the next year.
Right.
And then go forward and go. So you would like at some point to do some large-scale case control studies.
Right.
Where you go into populations with and without disease and you say, is the virus present? But before you do that, you really need a reliable assay that is not prone to contamination of any sort. It doesn't make sense to go forward unless you have that.
Uh-huh.
So that's what we're trying to do in the next year, I think.
I mean, there were early indications or some indications of retroviral activity, you know, in the early, you know, late 80s and early 90s. And, you know, that effort to sort of show a retroviral connection, you know, sort of dissipated at some point.
Yes.
And I don't quite know, you know, again, the back history of that.
Yeah, we don't, nothing was ever proven, but it may be, it just wasn't the right time. Now we have much better technology to do all of this. This is the time when we can sort out etiology better than we ever have before. So if it's there, we'll find it. There's no doubt about it.
And, you know, it may very well be that, you know, again, probably there's multiple etiologies. And if there is a viral connection, and, you know, I'm not a virologist, I don't know. If there is a viral connection, it's possible that that would be applied to, you know, 48%, you know, and some people may have primary depression who have been self-identified as having chronic fatigue syndrome. I don't know. There's probably some percentage that do have that sort of, you know, complex of whatever. And maybe there's other virus. I mean, who knows? I don't know. I mean, I don't think that this is going to, if they find this, that it would be the answer for everybody who now has been identified as having chronic fatigue syndrome, but maybe, you know, for some.
Right.
Or for a large chunk.
No, it didn't. It needn't be one cause. That's I think we have to keep that in mind. And the virus may cause multiple diseases, which could happen as well.
That could be too. I mean, if it's implicated in prostate cancer and chronic fatigue syndrome, and, you know, who knows if there's others. I don't know. I mean, where is the current thinking of MS and you know, virus or retrovirus? Is that?
No, the MS went through its viral phase, and none of the findings were substantiated. So at the moment, there isn't any viral etiology, as far as I see in the literature.
But is there sort of a suspicion still that it could be, or is it sort of now that idea out of the picture?
I don't think it's ever out of the picture, because as we've seen with XMRV, you can always have surprises. But I don't see any activity in virology at the moment, but doesn't mean that it won't come back one day. So let me end with back to the original thread, journalism and science. So it's like oil and water in some ways, because journalists aren't scientists, yet science is important for people to understand. And when we get press releases like we did from the Wellcome Trust, which overstate a conclusion, that's what most people read in their evening. What can we do about that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there has to be education all along the way. So I think researchers need to be humble, and they need to, you know, I think researchers should be, I'm not an instructor, but there should be some, you know, assurance that a press release conforms to the study. And, you know, that's imperative. And the people writing the press release should actually understand the study and have read it. And I think that's something that needs to happen on the academic science side, not on the journalism side.
Yeah.
I think on the journalism side, I think it would help if there were more people like you, if there were more people who were interested in communicating with a general public, who were out there doing that and have some skills in terms of doing that. Obviously, it will help if there's, you know, more journalists who understand, you know, public health. But it's not, there's no end to the process. It's just an improvement. It's a continual, hopefully, improvement. You know, and I think part of it is that the media environment has to sort itself out. So, you know, so we have to kind of, you know, nobody knows what the media business model is of the future at this point. And so without knowing that, it's hard to be in the journalism training, you know, journalism teaching, because you don't know what you're teaching them for. I'm kind of lucky because I'm teaching them a content area and I don't have to teach them how to tweet, you know. And from my perspective, if all they're doing is tweeting about health, if the health information is correct, I don't care if they do it in tweets. I don't care if they do it in blogs. I don't care if they do it in podcasts. I don't care where they do it. I just want the health information to be accurate.
Right.
So whatever medium they choose is fine with me, as a instructor or teacher, you know, or whatever. You're right that our program is a very small thing. It's going to have a minimal impact. But maybe as an example or as a statement, I mean, what I partly like is one that we're doing it too. In doing it, I can do interviews like this and I can sort of publicly advocate for better communication and have that platform to do that.
Yeah.
Modest platform, but a platform nonetheless.
You go little steps at a time.
you know, and I think, again, I sometimes like to write stories about the, you know, I really liked your quote in the story I did last week, that if you can't understand this, how can lay people? I mean, I think focusing on the miscommunications in science is very interesting as a journalistic subject, and informative to people.
Yeah.
Who read it.
That's why I wanted to get it right.
Right.
One thing you've said, scientists should be humble.
Well, everybody should be humble.
Everyone should be, but in particular scientists, because they have often not been and not communicative. Having an online forum, you're not prepared for the questions. They're all different, and they really teach me. And I find that an incredible learning experience.
Oh, that's so great. I find, you know, it's great now, like they, you know, to get the, you know, when I was working at the Chronicle, the newspaper, you know, maybe you got a phone call if you wrote a big story.
Yeah.
But almost always, if you got a phone call, it was bad. Like, they didn't like it or something. You know, but it also takes a lot of effort for people to call or write. And so, like, they posted on the, they referenced the story last week on the Well blog that they have. Mm-hmm. And that blog, that posting, which is where they had comments, not on the story itself, but on this reference to the story on the blog, got like 150 comments within a couple hours. You know, it's kind of amazing to read that and to be able to see how people are responding.
Your Times pieces can be commented on as well, right?
Some of them can. This one, for some reason, they mentioned it in the blog, that's where they had the comments. Maybe if they hadn't mentioned it in the blog, they would have just had the comments on the piece itself.
I think that's good to have a dialogue whenever something's written.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting, and it's very interesting to read the things that people write.
David, thank you for talking.
No problem. Very interesting.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. And
stay in touch.
Okay.
I want to thank David again for taking the time to speak with me. I think we had a nice, wide-ranging conversation, which touched not only on how to report about science in the press, but also on specific issues with respect to chronic fatigue syndrome and AIDS. There are many ways you can listen to TWIV on iTunes or at the Zune Marketplace. You can also stream the episodes to your iPhone or Android device with the Microbe World app, which you can find at microbeworld.org. You can always go to twiv.tv, listen right there, or download the episodes, and where you can find our show notes. If you like TWIV, please tell others about it. Links and reviews in iTunes are particularly helpful. Please send us your questions and comments. We love getting them. Send them to twiv@twiv.tv. I'm Vincent Racaniello, and you can find me at virology.ws. You've been listening to This Week in Virology. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week. Another TWIV is viral.